little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Well, a very hearty welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelich, and I'm here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hello, Bob. Good to be here, wherever that is.
Well, Julia, for this episode, we're all connected up with a great guest that I'm looking forward to talking with. And but let's kick it off, as we usually do, by telling folks how they can get in touch with us and how they can get access to our previously archived podcast version of Thinking Clearly.
Yes, well, Bob and I are getting quite acclimated to living here on the internet in bytes and bits, which is where you can find us. We're all over the internet. We are on Facebook. Just search us Thinking Clearly Radio. It should come right up with our Facebook page. And of course, we are podcasted. You can go to thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.com. Or what I prefer to do, I open up my favorite podcast app and I search Thinking Clearly, and we come right up, and you can subscribe to our show and automatically download it every month when it's published. Did I cover all the bases there, Bob?
I think you covered them all. And linking to the topics for this episode of Thinking Clearly, earlier this year, there was an opinion piece in the New York Times, and it was titled, "I Talked to the Cassandra of the Internet Age." And that was referring to our guest on this episode of Thinking Clearly. Now, if you're not up on the term Cassandra, it's from Greek mythology. And Cassandra has come to mean somebody who gives accurate warnings about the future bad events. And it comes from the ancient Greek mythology, when Cassandra, who was the daughter of the king of Troy, was given the gift of accurately foretelling the future by the god Apollo. So with that little clue in mind, why don't you help us be a little more specific about the topics we're going to cover, Julia?
Okay, well, I appreciate that little primer there, Bob. Today we're going to be talking about attention economy, contributions of the attention economy to mis and disinformation in our information streams, and as well as what businesses, government, and concerned citizens can do to reduce the pollution in our information ecosystem.
And that Cassandra of the internet age, featured in the New York Times opinion piece that I just mentioned at the beginning of the show, is Michael Goldhaber. And he's our guest on this edition of Thinking Clearly. And with a PhD in physics, Michael took the road less traveled, as we're going to hear about. And he charted a new course in his thinking and his activism. In his bio that you can read on the P2P Foundation page, he's described as, quote, a writer and a consultant living and working in the San Francisco Bay Area. Michael, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello, Bob and Julia, and the audience. It's a pleasure to connect with you and to be in touch with what's going on up north. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much joining us, Michael.
We're looking forward to it.
I just do want to mention at the top of the show that for folks listening to this live broadcast of Thinking Clearly, we will be taking calls with questions for our guest about the topics we're discussing today. That'll happen around 7:45 or so. We'll announce that the phone lines are open and give the call-in numbers when the lines do open. And we remind listeners to the podcast or rebroadcast of this show that the option to call in is only available to listeners of this live broadcast on KMUD. Michael, again, thanks so much for joining us this evening. As Bob had mentioned, your professional education was with theoretical physics, but you left that career and you became interested in social issues and the interface between politics and technology. So could you fill us in some of the details relating to this change of directions that you had and help us understand what prompted your forecasts about the internet and attention economy that you wrote about in the 1990s.
Thanks. Well, I'll try to make a long story short because it is really pretty long. I was in college and graduate school in the 60s with the Vietnam War raging, the civil rights movement, the beginning of the environmental movement and all sorts of things like that. And it so happened that my PhD advisor, this was at Stanford, was one of LBJ's science advisors and was quite gung-ho on the Vietnam War. And that deeply troubled me, all the more so right after I got my PhD, when I discovered that he had actually been very involved in setting up what was called the electronic battlefield. But also, that was a time when it seemed that theoretical particle physics was getting close to wrapping up the laws of nature in just a few simple axioms. And that's what I had been working on. And in one way, that was very exciting. But about a year after getting my PhD, wrapping everything up in just eight simple axioms or some such number as that, maybe even fewer, seemed to me too cold and sterile as a way of understanding the world. And it didn't seem like it would satisfy me as my life's work. So I began to wonder what to do instead. So for 10 years or so, I explored many avenues. I got very political and active in various things. Eventually, I stumbled on trying to understand the social impacts of new technologies. And I was especially focused on the microprocessor chip, which was pretty new at that time. I mean, everybody has lots of them these days in their phones and computers and their old computers probably hanging around somewhere. But at that time, they were quite new, and they were considered information technology. So what was information technology about? As I began to delve into that, I realized that at the same time as we were talking about these wonderful new technologies for information, lots of people were complaining, this was 40 years ago I'm talking about, of an information glut, too much information, more than people could take in, coming from all sorts of channels. No internet at that time, but faxes and Xeroxes and many TV channels and all sorts of things like that. Yet the promise was for more and more information in circulation. So I began to focus on the dilemma. Why produce more when there's already a glut? That doesn't make sense in terms of most things. If you have a glut, you normally start cutting back on producing whatever it may be. The reality was that something else had to be going on. And I kept trying to figure out what it was. And one day in a flash, about 1982, the insight came to me that when information goes one way, attention can go the other. Let me repeat that. Information goes one way, attention goes the other. People want attention. It's hard to get. So they send out information of one sort or another. That's the attention economy in basically one line, as I understood it then. To add a little more, as I added to my understanding in the next few years, to start at the very basic thing, we humans are mammals. And all mammals must have attention for some time after being born just to survive. And some, that just means being nursed by their mothers. In others, it means being protected. And, I assume you have deer up there and you see the does taking care of the fawns and things like that. And every mammal does it. But for humans, the period of absolute need for attention is much longer than it would be even for deer or anything like that. It's similarly long, incidentally, for elephants and so forth. But for us, the period of absolute need for attention in order to survive and become human lasts at least 4 or 5 years. For that time, mostly, it helps to like attention. If you enjoy getting it, you're better off in a way. You keep trying to get it and so forth. So, when we're children, we really need and want attention usually. Why stop if we could keep getting attention? So we're social animals. Everybody knows that about humans, but some people may not be so insistent on craving it for one reason or another, but most of us want some of it, and some of us might want a lot of it. And unlike food, for instance, I mean, you could stuff yourself to the max, but there's only so much food you can eat. But there's no natural limit on the amount of attention we might desire. So that took me into the early 90s, I suppose. And when the internet came along, I realized at once that its natural economy would be an attention economy, meaning the exchange of attention, the competition for attention, the connection between people through getting and giving attention, or as we say, paying attention. So I wrote and lectured about that, and I eventually wrote what you referred to in Wired, I think, as well as in the online academic journal called First Monday. And that was about the late 1990s. So that sort of explains where I was.
Very well explains it. So 30 years ago, you were writing about these issues, and 40 years ago, you were beginning to think about the issues and putting it together. Let's zip up to the present time now, Michael, and talk about something that happened more recently. In fact, it was sometime early this year. You get a call from Charlie Wartzell. He's the opinion writer at large for the New York Times. And he then subsequently, after he talked to you, he interviewed you and published an article on February 4th with the captivating and dramatic title, and I'll give you the full headline for it. It goes like this: I talked to the Cassandra of the internet age. The internet rewired our brains. He predicted it would. So that must have caused quite a stir. I can imagine that your telephone got pretty busy after that article. How did that feel, being recognized for something that you thought about and talked about years ago, a term, attention economy, that's become so prominent, such a buzzword in our present zeitgeist?
Well, I have to say, I had more or less given up on my ideas ever getting wide understanding, although I knew that attention economy as a term was used widely, and I believed and still believe that I originated the term, and I have evidence for that, but that's sort of irrelevant. But anyway, you know, Charlie Wartzell plunged me back in, and you know, I was amazed. I was startled. I thought it was wonderful. I felt very gratified and renewed. And now I'm trying to get the word out again in various ways.
That's kind of ironic, right? You,
yeah.
You were talking about attention and had a hiatus from attention for a few years, and now the attention is back on you. That, I see the irony in that.
Yeah, well, there is an irony, and I guess I have mixed feelings about attention. My own experiences have been, on the few occasions I've been speaking before a large audience that's actually present, you feel the attention. Let's say you're in a big auditorium or something like that. You feel the attention, and it's very energizing and uplifting and a very positive experience. But on the other hand, going after attention is something that a lot of people, including me, are rather shy about. Mm-hmm. So I like it when I have it, but I'm not very good at going after it.
That is really interesting. So, you know, here we are in 2020. What year are we in? We're in 2021. It's been an interesting and difficult year or so.
Don't take us back to 2020.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, but 2021 is half over. So,
oh my goodness. So that must be really interesting now, kind of having a retrospective to those ideas that you shared in the late 90s of your predictions. Which turned out to be, in your opinion, the most accurate, and which ones turned out to be kind of differently than you expected?
I think the basic idea that I put forward of intensified competition for attention, the constant increase in demands on attention, and the integration of much of the world in this has proved valid, you know, even in some ways beyond anything I could dream, because with things like cell phones and smartphones and easy ways to get on the internet, a huge number of people in the whole world are tied together in this giant new kind of system. But there were some things that I didn't foresee, such as that new corporations like Facebook, for example, or Twitter would emerge and try to dominate the attention flow, nor that attempts to make money from targeted advertising would grow so powerful. So also, I didn't exactly foresee social media like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, but they are perfectly designed to increase the competition for attention. Anyone on a social media site can see how many friends or followers you have, can share something of yours to get both of you more attention, can indicate by clicking on the word like or just a heart symbol that they applaud what you say, or they can just simply comment. And even something like the New York Times, for instance, I was much gratified that Charlie Worzel's article got something like 843 comments. So when people comment on the Times website, if you subscribe to that and have looked at it, there again you can get likes, and people can reply to the comments and so on and so forth. So that's a mini social media thing right there. And the fact that so many people are willing to do this and are eager, in fact, to do it, suggests just how strong and dominant is the idea of going out and seeking attention, which doesn't mean that everybody does it, but huge numbers of people do. So on the one hand, the social media democratize attention seeking, at least seeking, by making it so easy. All you have to do is set up your Facebook thing or your Twitter thing or get approved to comment on the Times site, which is very easy. So wherever in the world you are, you can get attention. On the other hand, what the social media do that's part and parcel of that is they hugely increase the competition for attention. It's now, I'm on Twitter and I look at it fairly often, actually, and very many people comment multiple times a day on Twitter, at least among the people I follow. I tend not to be one of them, but, you know, that's irrelevant. Basically, it's something everybody wants, or not everybody, but a huge number of people want to be connected with.
As a follow-up to that question about what did you predict, which came true and which didn't turn out exactly like you thought it might, I want to talk about what I think was a core thesis in some of the writings that I read of yours, especially in that 1997 article that you wrote for Wired magazine. And I'm going to quote from that. It was like this, quote, "In fact, as the attention economy becomes dominant, the advertising industry won't exist as it does today, since its point is to induce people to spend money. In the future, ads will exist only to attract and direct attention because money will be obsolete," end quote. So my question is, can you explain that idea just a little bit to our listeners? It's a very interesting idea. And do you still believe that that will happen, or have we just not gotten to that point yet?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I have to say that partly that was a wrong prediction, but instead, what's happened, which I partly expected, was that money would, to a certain extent, track attention, and I think that's still true. And one way to think about that is the big, what we call tech companies in the tech industry, which generally includes things like Google and Apple and Facebook and Amazon and so forth. what you can really all think of them as is attention industries. They channel attention. Now, if somebody has attention, I always thought that they can get whatever they want, including money, if they have enough attention. And that's always been true. I mean, stars of any kind who had a lot of attention could get some money. It was easier for some people than others. But and now we even have things like GoFundMe, where you can basically just say, I want money, send it to me for this reason or that reason or no reason at all. But so I was a little wrong in predicting sooner that money would disappear soon. But I think that in another way, the attention economy can exist without money. That is, people simply exchange attention in one way or another. Some people get more, some people get less, and the world, to some extent, or increasingly, revolves around that, and it exists sort of separately from the money system. But obviously, it has pulled in money much more than I realized. And so let me talk a little bit about advertising. I mean, as you may know, most corporations that sell anything at all think that about 10% of their revenues should go to advertising so that they will get new customers. And so they used to do that through newspapers and radio stations and all sorts of ways like that. But now they do it increasingly, supposedly, through the targeting of ads, because as you may know, and probably know very well, Google and Facebook and so forth and Amazon spend a huge amount of effort and technology trying to track what people are interested in and giving them ads that supposedly will cause them to buy everything. Now, I think that my generation and yours, Bob, I think, grew up with TV ads that, you know, start when you're, you know, very young and try to get you to buy all sorts of stuff. We learned not to be totally influenced by that, at least partially. We become somewhat immune from that. And I think the younger generation is similarly, you know, immersed in this advertising world and probably becoming immune from it too, because they could see that something they said or wrote or tried to order or whatever caused them to get a barrage of ads, and they'll sort of discount that. So I do think that ultimately the advertising will be less and less effective, and the material economy that stands behind that will also, I think, more begin to disappear. So in the long term, I may be right. In the short term, I certainly was not right.
You answered the question that I asked by saying that we just haven't reached that point yet. You're not wrong until you're wrong.
And it's, yes, and, yeah, that's right.
And, yeah. But that's fine, because I agree, we haven't seen the end of the road. Because it started out, the way I think about it, it started out, we were actually getting a quid pro quo. People were on the internet were offering us something that we wanted. And so we went to that site, and when we went to the site, they got our attention and essentially sold that attention to their sponsors, because they put their ads mm-hmm. there and then we clicked on it. So our attention was being converted into money, which paid for the information that the source, news, or whatever was giving us. And that's how it started. But then it looks like, and there's some pretty smart folks out there that are documenting this, that they got into the targeting advertising, as you said, collect data on us so they can shape the kinds of things we see so that mm-hmm. it is more apt. It's more of a magnet for our attention. They can predict our behavior. And also, they can get our emotionality involved by targeting things that upset us, make us angry, make us more predictable in terms of what we're actually going to click on. So some people view it as a huge real-time experiment in the shaping of human behavior. Do you think that's going to continue that way, or do you think it's going to continue more because of some kinds of influences towards the utopian rather than dystopian scenario?
Well, you know, I think what you said is dystopian, but there's another side of dystopia that I think has to be emphasized again. And even without advertising, that would occur, it seems to me, although it's partly generated by the kind of algorithms that these large companies have to, for example, decide what gets top billing in your feed on Facebook or something like that, which can be another person, not necessarily an ad. And my point is that people are competing for attention, and because attention is so desirable, they try to find ways of competing for it that are particularly successful. So if you want attention, are you likely to get it by just repeating what everybody thinks is the case? Or are you more likely to get it if you somehow distort that, if you come up with some wild claim or some lie, or you invite some other people into some kind of in-group, or perhaps you insult a specific group or individual? All those things are likely to get more attention than just saying, well, you know, the world is round and everybody lives on it, and this is what is happening in a very calm and more or less thoughtful and scientific way. So unfortunately, I mean, if you think of things like QAnon, for example, I don't know whether it's very strong influence up where you live, but certainly in many parts of the country, lots of people believe in QAnon. And that started completely on the internet, as far as I know, with one person. It wasn't advertising. I think it and similar things led up to the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, which was, I think, part of the reason that Charlie Wurzel ended up looking me up. So as I see it, this is perhaps the most frightening thing to me, that views that no advertiser would dare espouse, or very few advertisers would dare espouse, still get currency on Facebook and Twitter and everywhere else. And for example, President Trump at the time espoused them. And that's a big danger in the world. We suddenly see a lot more authoritarian figures who were democratically elected, not only President Trump, but the presidents of Hungary, Turkey, India, all over the world, have basically gotten new powers partly through their use of the internet, as far as I can make out. And so these are people in apparent democracies who nonetheless get undemocratic power. And that's a grave danger that we have to face. It's even worse, as far as I'm concerned, than somebody selling me the wrong pair of shoes or something like that.
It is really interesting, especially how far we've come, for better and for worse. Assuming, you know, folks are interested in these kind of things and want to, you know, leverage the tools that we have, where do you think we can best concentrate our efforts to turn the present negative effects of the attention economy into assets that we can use to make the world a better place?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I certainly don't feel I have all the answers, but I do. About three things come to mind in connection with that question. Number one, I think we have to try hard to emphasize our common humanity in everything we put forth. There have been internet-led movements like Black Lives Matter or Me Too or the movement to take climate change more seriously that are all, in my view, highly positive. And when we support those, I think we need to emphasize that they are movements of inclusion, not exclusion, We want Black people's lives, for instance, to be treated as just as valuable as white people's or anyone else's. We want women to be treated with their full dignity as individuals, not as sex objects. We want to save the planet for everyone. It's very easy on Twitter, for instance, to say something short and punchy, but it's harder to be thoughtful. But we have to find ways to do that. Number two, I think we have to be careful, and a lot of people are not sufficiently, to share things that are sincere and generous, not vile as insulting and insulting. For instance, as an anti-Trump person, I think it's so easy for me to take pleasure in when Trump or his allies get into trouble, rather than, say, in supporting Biden's attempt to find real solutions to a lot of the problems that were raised. So, you know, in other words, trying to support someone who tries to be kind and generous rather than being snotty and mean. And, you know, that's hard to do. I mean, I'm a person who gets very angry and upset with certain things. But I think in what we put out, we have to try to curb that. And the third thing is, don't be a hypocrite. I mean, maybe it's somewhat similar to the others, but don't try to trick people. Be honest and also modest, I would say. For example, you know, I was very interested in seeing Democrats win in the 2020 election, all the way down, you know, certainly including Congress and even state legislatures and things like that. And so I gave some money, and I got, for every dollar I gave, I probably got 50 or 100 emails. These emails often, I don't know who wrote them, but they're completely insincere very often. They say, for instance, you would get two emails from the same campaign within 15 minutes of one another, one saying, "Oh my God, we're losing, we're losing." And the next one saying, "We're on the road to victory," you know, each trying to draw on very simple emotions to get us to give money. Now, I think most people aren't that stupid, and they realize that this is probably not appealing. But, you know, what I happen to think happens, and I may be quite wrong because I haven't really studied it, is that political consultants are basically, you know, kind of advertisers, not very slick ones even. And they run these email campaigns and they do a bad job of it. And as a result, they bring about a great deal of mistrust, I think. And, you know, it's not just those people, but plenty of other people who also then try to use very superficial emotions, as you somewhat mentioned, to get people to do one thing or another. And we have to say, don't try to manipulate us. Don't try to be manipulative. Try to be honest and sincere, though that's very hard. And so those are three thoughts. And, you know, I think that's the basic thing we can do.
I'm glad you're taking that approach because, you know, some of the discussions that I've heard about what we can do or what can be done to make it better are government regulation of the internet companies and social media platforms. And that's one approach. Another approach is for us to put social pressure on rather than lobby for government regulation, to put social pressure one way or the other on internet companies and social media platforms to change some of their tactics and policies. What we're all about on this show is just what you got into there is don't be a hypocrite. Talking about what we can do as listeners of this show, what we can do as critical thinkers. So let's focus on that a little bit, because on a podcast I heard you mention the importance of critical thinking and how we can all do our part in making sure that that information that we pass on is good information. And that's been one of our main themes that we've talked about. In fact, that is the main theme in this show, is we're here to help people understand the process of critical thinking, not to debate issues, but to actually learn the skills of critical thinking. So they'll have that in their toolkit as a way of addressing these issues. And I've talked a lot about, I don't know if Julia likes the term so well, information activist. I like that term. And the way I think about that term, being an information activist, is someone who vets information that they come across first and not passing it along until they have properly vetted that information and are as convinced as they can be that that's accurate information, reliable information, and worthy of being passed on. And secondly, to get a little even more active than that would be to, in as genuine, authentic, and in good spirit, confront information when you see that it's really misinformation. And I've started doing that with people that are in my feed on Facebook. And when I see something that I just know that, you know, mm-hmm. my skeptics meter pegs on that, I'll check it out, I'll vet it, I'll fact check it and that kind of thing. And then I will use my relationship with that person, because I wouldn't have a relationship with them if they weren't on my feed, you know, a friend. Mm-hmm. And I'll use my relationship with them as authentically as I can, in as much civil dialogue as I can muster, to confront that and give them something to think about. So that's what I mean by information activist. Now, how does that sound to you? What are your thoughts on people in general becoming a force for changing this around?
Well, let me think about it, think out loud about it a little bit in terms of something else, which is, you know, as I have mentioned throughout this thing, I like to use the term attention rather than information. And of course, that's mm-hmm. going the other way. Let's think about it this way. For example, right now, at this second, you and your audience are presumably paying attention to me. Let's consider how that works. My thoughts start in my mind, somehow turn into words and sentences, which get into sound waves through my mouth and vocal system, and end up in a complicated succession of electronic steps that bring it to your ears or other people's ears, and where it gets your, even before it gets to your ears, it's converted back into sound waves, of course. And then your mind has to turn it back into thoughts. So you end up thinking somewhat similarly to what I had been thinking. So in that sense, when you're paying me attention, I have a certain kind of control over your mind. But, you know, for any good to develop from that, you have to take it a step further. I could say, you know, the moon isn't made of green cheese, it's made of blue cheese or something like that. And you would then presumably think to yourself, oh, that isn't the way it is at all. You may or may not say it out loud, but I think everybody has to go through the process of saying whatever somebody says, is this good? Is this something I want to think and keep thinking and keep acting on, or is it something else? And, you know, an example that occurs to me is, suppose you're talking to a four-year-old child. It could be your child, your grandchild, somebody you care about somewhat. You certainly want to be respectful to them if they say something, but you don't necessarily want to take it to be reality or true, because it might be something they just imagined or made up or thought was the case. And so you don't automatically believe whatever they say. And in some ways, we have to take everything to a certain extent, not just something that we can think ourselves, but something that we have to stop and consider. Now, on the other hand, you can't go all the way with that. You can't be skeptical about everything or you'll go mad. I mean, so how you get a happy medium between those two things is is a kind of challenge that we're all in. And I think the only way to do it is to take time to slow down in some way or another and go through what we're hearing and what we're seeing. And, you know, because today, as you know, for instance, you could see something that looks extremely real and it would be entirely artificial and the result of computer graphics or whatnot. So we all know that the world and our experiences of it can even be distorted. And the only way to check that is, you know, by, it seems to me, not giving up on long-term thinking, not giving up on intense conversations, not giving up on connecting with the experience that we most believe to be true, and not giving up on taking into account the experience of others who have really worked hard at something. I'm struck by something that Dr. Fauci said not that long ago. You know, at first, when the pandemic arrived, he said, we probably shouldn't rely on masks because there weren't enough masks to go around. But what he said more recently is, you know, it's science, and science goes by what it understands at the moment, but it can always change that. And I think that's true even beyond science, that we have to be ready to see that there's something else. And that's sort of my answer. But, you know, basically, I agree with you in the fundamentals. We obviously need to pause before we accept anything. And we need to, if we are pretty sure we understand what's really going on, to say so.
Michael, as you were talking, I was thinking you're covering some of the information, but some of the instances, but what about the rage machines? What about the people who weaponize information? And they are really seductively drawing attention and getting us to the point where they know who we are. They know that we're susceptible to some triggering thing that they're saying. And it happens on both the left and the right. It's not just the right,
yes,
it's the left and the right that this happens on. How about that? How do we deal with that?
Well, I'm not sure I have an extremely good answer to that, but I think we have to stop and think. Certainly if someone says something that is really sounds strange or possibly off the wall or perhaps a lie or an insult, we should obviously be careful about it. For instance, when people start attacking Asian Americans because of the coronavirus, that's just, you know, being totally illogical and racist and very superficial. And, you know, obviously there's no absolute way to keep that from happening, but I think we have to say, you know, you're not thinking right when you're saying something like that, or if you're accepting something like that, because, you know, this person, I don't know whether you've seen the examples, but, you know, in San Francisco, where there are plenty of Asian Americans, you know, elderly people just walking down the street have been attacked for no reason whatsoever. And just to think that they could somehow be responsible for the virus or for any of the effects of it, like, you know, people losing their jobs or whatever it might be, is completely incoherent. Now, I don't think you can automatically convince everyone of that, but you know, obviously, that message has to be countered very directly. And, you know, any other kind of hate message, I think, also needs to be countered. And I don't have any complete answer, but I would just say we should be very aware when we're being bombarded in that way that something is wrong. And I think that has to be said.
That's the tough thing to do, though, because it's so effective. And we've talked on this show before about System 1 and System 2 thinking, the System 1 being the quick, intuitive, emotionally mm-hmm. laden thinking, which is mm-hmm. which we rely on mostly. And the other System 2 is the more deliberate. That's what you're appealing to in what you're saying, is that more deliberate, thoughtful part of our thought processes. So we're back to that Julia and I have talked about quite a bit on this show, is there are rage machines out there. They're designed to make us angry, to trigger us, whether we're right or on the right or on the left. They know what triggers us. And they're out there to incite us, to get us into a frenzy to some extent. And therefore, they're going to benefit somehow. They'll be able to advance their agenda, or they'll solicit money for, you know, that cause or whatever. And Julia, I want you to chime in on this too, you know, how do we actually get people who are susceptible to that? How do we get them to the point where they can shift gears into that System 2, more deliberative thinking?
Well, again, I'm not sure I have any very good answers to that, but the one thing that I would disagree with you on is, emotional thinking includes empathy, when you see somebody knocked down in the street, you can either take the side of the person who knocked them down, or you could take the side of the person who was knocked down. And I think we need that counter image, you know, somebody's in trouble, let's figure out how to help them. I remember back in the 70s or 80s and so forth, there would be pictures on TV of famines in Africa, for example, and that elicited a huge amount of support for doing something like sending food. And I think, for example, when this horrible thing happened in Florida, I don't think there are that many people who are just angry about it, although there are reasons to be, but they're also, full of sadness for what happened. And I think we have to allow that kind of emotion. And to some extent, we have to train people that it's all right to have that kind of emotion, and not only train people, but give it as an example, you know, showing caring and, the fact that we can understand what it feels like. I think during the pandemic, I at least saw a great deal of that. Somebody talking about, you know, my father is dying and I can't go there and be with him. And this is just so painful and awful. Even on Twitter, people do something like that, and huge numbers of people respond to that. So I think, you know, just thinking of all emotion as rage and hate and fear isn't the right way to do it. We have to also capture those emotions that are more supportive and caring and empathetic that we all have. I mean, that we understand the terror of losing a child or something like that.
I think you bring up a really good point, which is that it is an integral part of our system, you know, to have emotional responses. I see, especially lately, people saying on the internet things like, don't be so angry, don't be so mad, you know, that's more of a negative emotion. But if you take a step back, you know, there are things worth being mad about. And that can become the motivation for how you respond. But going back to what you said earlier, that really the importance of slowing down and, you know, taking a look, maybe the emotion is what prompts to take a look at that, but then slowing mm-hmm. down and taking a closer look about, you know, I am upset I can't see my father in the hospital, but I'm not going to go beat a random Asian person because I'm angry. You know, that's not the appropriate response. Yeah. So I think you brought up a really good point there.
I hate to go down this dystopian road. I'm usually very optimistic in these things, as Julia can attest to, overly optimistic sometime. But
oh, yeah. Bob's the really far-out optimistic guy, and I'm usually the dystopian one.
You hit on it. My optimism is on the long term. We're not at the long term at all. We're in a point, in my opinion, that things are pretty scary in terms of the information that we're being exposed to. And even positive emotions can be weaponized, because they can weaponize those. Then somebody did something to somebody else, or we should be doing something. And that means that the government is, you know, not doing what it is. And so it can be weaponized. It's that weaponization of information that I'm kind of stuck on and trying to find a way around. We're getting close to the top of the hour. So let me ask you this, because after a long hiatus of publicly sharing your views with this recent barrage of attention, has that motivated you to actively re-engage with the issues of information attention and progress toward shaping a better world? If so, how might you do that in the future? How might you come back and help this situation?
Okay, well, let me just say, anyway, all through especially the last few years, I've been deeply concerned about the future of the human race, about democracy, about peace, and about how we preserve and protect the natural world. And I am trying to relate those concerns now to my earlier work on the attention economy. So one of the things I'm doing is trying to work up a viable book proposal, and also posting occasional new reflections on my blog, which is at goldhaber.org. And one of the latest ones has to do with meritocracy, which is a subject that Michael Sandel at Harvard recently wrote about. I haven't read his book, but I heard a talk, and that was maybe right about that. But at the same time, let me just say, I occasionally tweet something or other, but at 78, I feel somewhat comfortable deferring to a younger generation. I must say, I thought that I would do that when I was 40 or so, or maybe even younger, but I wasn't able to completely. But, you know, an organization I was involved in founding a long time ago was called Science for the People. That was over 50 years ago, and it flourished for a while, and then it completely died, but now it's been reborn, and I think it's more active than ever, all with people, or almost entirely with people considerably younger than myself. And I see that as a good sign. And I see the younger generation, there was a generation that became completely apathetic about politics and such things, maybe in the 80s and 90s and things like that. Nowadays, when I see young people who are, you know, in their early 20s, a lot of them are great activists, for example, the Sunrise Movement or Black Lives Matter or the Women's March after President Trump got elected. These are more, I have to admit, on the left, but I suspect there are good people on the right who are not so extreme. And, you know, hopefully people will take up their cause however they want to do it, in a peaceful way. And let me say one more thing about anger, if we have another minute, which is you can be angry at a particular person, or you can be angry at a system which you feel has to change. And I think it's important to distinguish those things.
Thank you very much for veering us over into a more optimistic course. And Michael Goldhaber, I want to thank you so much for sharing your intellectual journey and your insights with us on Thinking Clearly. And we're going to post some of those links that you mentioned, including the one that is the Oral History Project, which is really interesting, that details your history, how you became an activist and a person interested in how the world is going to shape for the better. I'll put links for that on our Facebook page. And I want to thank our listeners and our engineer, Sue Maloney. As always, thank you, Julia. And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.
Thank you.